The University of Johannesburg, the future reimagined.
Good morning from the podcast studio. The first time I am in conversation in a very much professional yet social setup at the University of Johannesburg's podcast studios in the Madibeng building. And I'm interviewing, in fact, I wouldn't even use the word interviewing. I'm engaging, getting to know, discussing, pondering, thinking out loud and engaging the philosophy of Vice Chancellor, who is 27 days in office, Ndade Letokwa George Mbedi, Professor, Doctor, a lawyer, Pi Excellence. Mhlekazi, good morning. Thank you so much for inviting me and for allowing me really this platform to engage with you as we are now.
Good morning, Songezo. You know, you are the right man for this role, and it's really an honor and a privilege to be interviewed by you. Thank you so much for setting time aside for this conversation.
On the 10th of March, I had the honor, among many, to be in the auditorium to watch the ceremony of ceremonies, but one that surely was for you, about you, and with you, the day of your confirmation and investiture as the Vice Chancellor of UJ. Take us back 2.5 weeks ago.
Yeah, that was very emotional. Look, it took a lot of preparation. We have a good team or teams here at UJ that made sure that the day was beautiful. But you can never tell how things will pan out. You know, I had to get my speech right so that it speaks to the people. I share my vision correctly. But for me, it was also about my mother. You know, it was a time of reflection. You know, my mother was in the crowd crying there all the time. And also many other people, I had to battle tears, you know, from rolling down my cheeks. Yeah, it was quite a special day for me, my family, and the UJ family, and many other people, including yourself. It was so great to see you there. And you look great in your traditional regalia.
Mm-hmm. I promised I would, and thank you so much for honoring that. I am Letlokwa George Mbedi, the son of Daniel Bule Mbedi.
Yeah.
A construction worker and Josephine Hambile Mbedi, a housewife. Take me back to your home, the setup in rural Limpopo, where this boy is born among many boys, no different for the most part. A mother at home, a father who's out there in the typical migrant labor system.
That's right.
He might not necessarily have been a migrant laborer himself, but he would not have been too different. You're a village boy. You're doing everything everyone else around you is doing, has done. You go to a home, fortunately, where there is a mother and father. But for a lot of the time, because of the work that your father does, is not there. Paint for us a picture of your childhood with that preface.
Firstly, my father originated from the Waterberg area, where my grandparents were farmhands. And my great-grandfather originated from Botswana. And after my parents got married, my mother is Swati from Hazy View. After they got married, they moved to this village in the Northwest Province, the former Bophuthatswana. That's where I grew up. And growing up there, it was just amazing. You know, I mean, I was like, when we moved to this village, I was 1 year old. And, you know, growing up with my homeboys, you know, doing all sorts of crazy things that boys do was just amazing. A carefree life, doing silly things. You know, when I reflect back, we used to go, we never had dogs at my house, you know, but guys from the neighborhood had dogs and would go hunting for nests of wasps. And there was this myth that if you feed your dogs this nest of wasps, they are going to be the vicious, most vicious dogs in and I'd come home with this big head, you know, having been bitten by wasps. And I had to explain to my mom how I got bitten. And then I'll get an extra hiding. So it was really strict upbringing. And it really took a village to raise someone like me, because any parent could discipline us without getting into trouble. And in terms of my dad was a construction worker. You know, would go to bed on a Friday and then Saturday, apologies, in the morning you wake up, the house smells good, you know, there are bananas and there are apples, daddy's home, you know. And then Sunday in the afternoon, he had to go back. So we barely saw our dad, you know. The time we'd spend a little bit of time with him was during the Easter break, Easter holidays, and for 2 weeks in December. But that was the same thing for almost every kid at our village. So we were raised by mothers who really, you know, took charge of their households and us and provided us with a lot of love and caring. Mothers were serious disciplinarians, you know, and you didn't get into trouble because if they knew that you were in trouble either at school or somewhere in the bush or on the road home, on your way home after school, you'd get additional hiding because they insisted that, you know, we should avoid getting into trouble by all costs. And that was the kind of upbringing that, or the picture that I can paint reflecting back. And me and my homeboys were like brothers. It was just like a whole brotherhood, you know, and that was special. I wish my son could experience this because he comes from school, he comes home, he's busy with his gadgets, he watches television, then his homework time. There's no time to go out there and just be boys, you know.
Well, he probably won't experience this because the eras are different.
That's right.
And the social challenges and demands are different. And unfortunately, the realities of seeking work, as in your case, it wouldn't be where you come from.
That's right.
But it would be around the main centers of the economy.
Yeah.
And this is something we have to touch on. Yeah. Certainly when you engage the vision and strategic direction for the university and your outlook, particularly as it pertains to your vision for the institution, but more broadly for society.
Yeah.
Let me come back, though, to this young boy.
Yeah.
You are literally living a life that I imagine millions of men your age, some older, some younger, would relate to. But there's a critical point here that I do want you to perhaps expand on a little bit more. The culture of discipline in the Bedi household and what that would have done for you in terms of orientating you for the things you were required to do and for the things in time you started having aspirations for yourself, which possibly then becomes at that stage a key differentiator between the Bedi household and other households, and by extension, you and your contemporaries in the fields.
Yeah. Look, my mother was quick to discipline us, you know. I mean, you know, she wouldn't think twice before she gives you a hiding for something that you might have done. She was that type of a lady. And she had this one-shot deal approach, you know, you miss, you're out. We grew up knowing that if you have a shot at something, take advantage of that opportunity. If it's gone, it's gone. For example, I used to grow up thinking this is the toughest mother on earth. You know, I lost my idler shoes, school shoes, once, and she made me walk barefooted that winter to school, and I never lost my shoes again since then. So that culture of looking after your belongings, even now, you know, I'm always aware of where is what. You know, and always, you know, my wife would say I am paranoid, you know, because I would say don't put your cell phone in your back pocket. Somebody might snatch it. It's my upbringing where my mother was really strict with us. And I'm so grateful for that, you know, whereas there are kids that never had that setup where they were held accountable. For example, you would go to a shop to buy a loaf of bread. If there is 23 cents change, you bring the whole change home. Whereas my homeboys, you know, they would buy sweets for themselves, and I wouldn't dare do that. You know, the school's closed. You know, I watched my son bring his school report, you know, to me. He didn't open it. It reminded me of us when we were growing up. You wouldn't dare open your school report in the streets. Other people would do that. And my mother would say, you can only open it if you pay your own school fees. Mm. So we wouldn't do such things. You would open it at home and not in the street. So it was a strict, you know, upbringing, but also a loving one, the more I think of it, you know. And obviously we didn't have lots of extra luxuries, you know. And growing up, Songezo, I would tell you, were five siblings. My mother didn't drink tea with bread. So I knew that loaf of bread has to produce, you know, 10 slices, 2 per sibling. And when it was my day to make tea in the morning, I can't tell you, you know, even on days that were not assigned to me to make tea for the family, how I yearned for that extra slice of bread. And I was outspoken. I would tell my mother, you know, when I grow up, I'm going to eat the whole loaf, you know. I would go
You can afford quite a few now.
Yeah, this is what she used to tell me. She said, well, now you're not working. When you're working, you can do that. But now it's 2 slices per person.
Mm.
You know, a liter of cold drink. Can't tell you when Pepsi came, you know, with that 1.25 liter, what it meant for us, because we would share the whole liter, just a little bit, and you wish as a child if you had more. And you say, when you are an adult, and you can buy more. We grew up eating morocco, you know, wild spinach. I don't like it that much because I ate so much of the stuff.
Sure, sure.
I used to tell my mother when I'm working at my household, we're going to eat meat every day. And
I'm sure you do.
No, I can't. My wife now tells me you cannot. You must have a balanced diet. You know, I'm like, yeah, a man can never have peace in this world. Growing up, you know, we used to have a brown bread for cost reasons. It was cheaper, but also healthier. And I thought when I'm an adult, I'm going to buy lots of white bread. My wife doesn't want to see white bread at the house. So there's never peace, you know. But it's one thing to dream, and I'm glad one could dream.
We're going to talk about Mama, yeah. Baby, the yeah. wife now, yeah. because it seems
yeah.
like
yeah.
you thought you were leaving your mom's home only to go into your mom's home only through your wife, yeah. which is an important characteristic,
it is.
I think, in successful setups.
Yeah.
One sort of yeah. tends to embrace
yeah.
the things that work, yeah. not necessarily comfortable,
yeah.
but things that work, and yeah. the culture of success
yeah.
tends to replicate itself and
That's
expresses
true.
Itself in many different forms.
Agreed.
But in many ways, the same way.
I could tell you that.
But now, Umama is a disciplinarian.
Yeah.
You are walking to school.
Yeah.
Importantly, yeah. to school.
Yeah.
There were many who you probably leave at home attending to the livestock.
Yeah.
And you come back and they yeah. are still attending to the yeah. livestock, only maybe because
yeah.
education was not a commodity that was valued in that setup.
That's true.
And there are reasons historically
yeah.
for that at an even social level.
Right.
So you are growing up.
Yeah.
So you are experiencing the love and discipline from Umama.
Yeah.
Udada, albeit absent, is yeah. consistent in terms yeah. of his schedule. He comes back on yeah. Fridays. On yeah. Sundays, he's yeah. gone. Mm-hmm. He comes with what expressions of love he can afford,
mm-hmm.
nice meats, fruits, whatever the case may be.
Yeah.
Easter time, a family time in the yeah. Christian setup, certainly. Mm-hmm. He is present.
Right.
And the promise of December, mm-hmm. he is there.
Yeah.
What did that do for you as a boy child who then becomes a man?
Yeah, I will tell you, even today I say it, my father loved his family, and I believe many other fathers those days did that. And he would come, many young people don't know about sales house, you know, there's a
sales
house where they yes. sold cloth. It was a clothing retail store.
It was a serious retail store.
It was. He would come there with clothes for all the 5 kids and his wife. He knew my mother's size. He knew his wife's size. He would buy a 2-piece suit, shoes. He knew everything for the whole family. And that thing is just an example of things that I do today. When I travel, I do buy my wife stuff. And people don't believe. You know, for example, we're in Ghana in a bus at a market, and I saw this beautiful dress, you know, and I said, that one is the one that I want for my wife. And I went there, you know, and then I bought it, and then we heckled a little bit, and I got that dress. When she puts it on, people say, where did you get this dress? Beautiful traditional dress.
Mm.
She says, my husband bought it for me. They say, you are lying. I go to China, and, you know, sizes are a problem, but I was successful there to bring a dress that fitted. You know, I say, look, bring your extra, extra, extra large dress here. They say, who is it for? I say, for my wife. They say, is your wife big? I say, I'm an African man. What do you expect?
Yeah, sure.
But she's not big. You saw my wife.
No,
you
she
know.
Isn't.
But in terms of sizes, you know, mm. and in feet. But where I got it wrong, and I learned the hard way, is that in Europe, there is a European size. Did you know something? That there is a European size?
I did not.
I didn't know. I picked a few dresses and I came there small. But look, back to the question. Seeing how loving my dad was, I don't remember a single day where my father was chasing us around and beating my mother. I never saw that. And that's why there's no violence in my household. And the message here to me is that children emulate what they see parents doing. So if children, boy children, today we talk about gender-based violence, if they see their dads respecting the family, this is what they're going to do when they grow up. That is one thing that I picked from my dad. He loved his family, and he loved his wife. He was the most caring father. And I tried to be somebody like him because I saw the happiness that, reigned supreme in our house, you know. I mean, those days they used to play LPs, you know. Mm-hmm. He had all sorts of them, Ladysmith Black Mambas. He loved Ladysmith Black Mambas. And then he would be dancing there with our mother. We were kids, you know. Mm. It's just incredible. And it was a happy, happy family.
I have no doubt, as you're telling me this, you are seeing it happen in your mind.
I do. Actually, you just saw it in my eyes, I'm sure. I mean, we didn't have a refrigerator, but mother's love. You know, would have jelly that my mother would let it set in the evening and put it on top of her heart. And then all.
How many times did you visit that jelly as it was looking to cool? With a teaspoon. Of course, the jelly is going to give you away because the minute it sets, it's there.
Yeah, no. I wouldn't dare. My mother was the strictest mother, as I told you, that it didn't worth it. You had to wait for your opportunity to. I wouldn't dare because I would be caught and I would get a hiding with that shoe, the morning slipper. Man, you'd hear it cracking on your bums as a kid. You know, it was not worth it. But talking about my upbringing, I have to share this with you. I hope people don't tease me. My mother, you know, we sold all sorts of things. She also used to make jerseys, the machine, the school jerseys for kids. Mm. And then somebody ordered a red jersey that she made, but there was extra wool left. So the old lady, I'm sure, didn't know what to do with that. So she decided to make a small, short pant-like thing for me with that wool. So I was skeptical, you know, at first, you know. I said, I can't wear this thing to play. I said, no, this is a short, you know. And I go out, the boys say, oh, he's got a woolen underpant. Hey, they teased me. I went home, I never wore the thing again.
I'm not going to say anything about the faces in this room that I'm seeing as we are doing this podcast.
Yeah.
I'm going to have to fast forward a little bit now. There's a critical stage, 15, 16, 17, where the invariable question is, what do you want to be when you are old? And it's not the same question. Certainly doesn't land the same as when, say, you are a 5 or 6 and you ask that question.
Yeah.
At 5 or 6, you just want to be a soldier, a police officer, or a fireman, because that's what you see.
Yeah.
And that's what you think is out there.
Yeah.
At 15, 16, 17, you're engaging now your society.
Yeah.
You've got rudimentary schooling that allows you to understand what is out there.
Yeah.
And the conversation of beyond high school.
Yeah.
What's going on? Who's guiding you?
Yep.
What information are you exposed to?
Yep.
And even as early as that then,
yep.
What are your aspirations for self?
Yeah, I'll tell you something weird perhaps. My dad, when he came home, he always wanted me to learn how to write my name, surname, because we didn't have a kindergarten those days. And I never liked it because I wanted to play with other kids. And he always said, no, you have to learn this because I want you to be a lawyer. So I grew up wanting to be a lawyer. And nobody could tell me what it meant. People say you lie and then a criminal walks free, that type of nonsense. At that age you have mentioned, I came across a fellow that I also acknowledged at my inauguration, Advocate Stevens Ramafuku,
who was
studying law at night. He was my karate instructor. And that put things in a clear perspective, what it entailed and what I needed. And I was more determined than ever. But at that stage, it was not clear that I will get an opportunity to go to university. And I knew what I wanted to do, but the question was, will I get an opportunity? And that opportunity came my way through Vista University. You know, Vista University, many people may not know, it really opened the door for many people because if you performed well, you got distinctions, you would get a rebate, you know. We call that merit awards. And through that, I can tell you, I mean, 1 year I would pay like 200 rands, 500 rands, and that gave me an opportunity. I'm sure I wouldn't be here had it not been for such a system with Vista University.
Let's talk about Ndade Stephen Ramafuku. I think his merits sometime, because first of all, there were very few and far between of his ilk.
Yeah.
Few and far between of his ilk who then have the kind of time to be a light and beacon for somebody who would have been stage or vice versa.
Mm.
And so his intervention, your parents would have done as much as they could have done for you.
Yeah.
But it was always going to be up to a point.
Yes.
If the construction worker and the housewife
yeah.
and their level of exposure to anything
yeah.
is to go by.
Yeah.
How did the Stephen Ramaphosa aspect come into play?
Yeah.
At what stage of your development where yeah. you were?
Yeah.
And talk us about the early engagements with him.
Yeah. Look, I was busy getting my high school education. And I will tell you, I may look like a harmless person, and I'm not saying I'm a dangerous man, but I was a naughty child, I'll tell you that. And growing up, because I didn't have older brothers who would fight my battles, and, you know, you didn't want to ask your sisters to fight your battles. So I didn't pick my battles well. I fought with anybody and whoever provoked me. And the aim there was not to win, because some of the people were much bigger than me and older than me. But I was proud of the fact that I stood my ground, you know. And I lost many battles or fights that I had. And I fought dirty. Whatever I grabbed, a rock, you know, it would land on your back. A stick, I would throw it your way. So I was really a nasty fighter. But the aim was not to win, but it was that I fought back. And when I met this gentleman, Advocate Stevens Ramaphosa, and started training with him as a karateka, then a sense of discipline started to develop in me. Look, I was a good student. I got good marks. I was often at the top of my class and all that. But without discipline, that would mean nothing. So my engagement with him started with talking about law. And he was like, no, man, I'm studying law at night. This is what a study guide looks like. This is a law textbook for criminal law, for example, family law. And wow, it started to sink in. And he saw something in me, you know, because quickly he made me sort of the secretary of the dojo. And I was very strict, you know. I remember I wanted us to kick out certain karatekas, ill-disciplined karatekas out of the dojo.
Because this guy, at Vista now?
No. High school. Yeah. And this karatekas would go beating other people at weddings. Because karate teaches you discipline. And after training with us, they'll go and train another style. Our style is Japanese full contact. They'll go and train Shotokan, which is not full contact. So I would say, let's kick them out. And he'll sit me down and says, no, we shouldn't do this. I understand, you know, unhappiness with these guys. But if we kick them out, who is going to guide them? We need them within the dojo so that we can mold them. That was leadership, isn't it? And working with him, you know, I learned a lot about discipline, hard work, respect, you know, treating people with dignity. But I always respected my elders and so on. But that really shaped me into the man that I am. And most of the principles I learned from him and from my karate days are still applied today in my leadership style.
Vista becomes UJ.
Yeah.
For you, at least,
yeah.
Your journey
yeah.
in academia.
Yeah.
You've wanted to become this top criminal
yeah,
lawyer.
Yeah,
you get
yeah,
your
yeah,
degree
yeah.
at Vista, and then you go to UJ.
Yeah.
Why don't you go into practice?
Now, you know, as I always mentioned to the people that sat down with me previously, is that I got bitten by the academic bug earlier. And I was like, this lawyer thing is not for me. I get too emotionally attached to things. And I enjoyed doing research. For example, when I was a student at Vista, I had a special letter because our library was not so good. I had a special letter to go to the University of Pretoria's library where I would get recent articles and so on. And my assignments were always good because I put in an extra effort. And
you had material that no one else generally
yeah,
had access
yeah.
to. Yeah,
people would come and ask to make photocopies of my material. And it felt good, and I shared with everyone. And I said to myself, look, I want to go all the way up to LLD, you know, doctoral level. And I said, academia is my thing. And I never looked back. I've been an academic all my professional life.
And I suppose what was important there was the affirmation, the consistent
yeah.
and constant affirmation.
Yeah.
I do well. I'm recognized.
Yeah.
I do well.
Yeah.
Now, suddenly, materially, it has a positive impact. I'm paying less.
Yeah.
So, therefore, there is a little more to go around at
yeah.
home
yeah.
or within the bursary scheme set
yeah.
up itself.
Definitely.
you are required to do an assignment.
Yeah.
You know that you can get 5, 6, 8, 10 yeah. extra percentage
yeah.
points.
Yeah.
If you access
yeah.
the use of that letter in Pretoria, you yeah. come back.
Yeah.
Sort of your street cred to yeah. today's language.
Yeah. yeah.
The game goes up, right? And Mbedi yeah. is the go-to
yeah.
person.
Yeah.
He's getting these marks. And yeah. it's no wonder why, because yeah. he's getting material that we don't have access
yeah.
to.
Yeah.
And people respond differently
yeah.
to you. And suddenly the universe conspires in your favor. You find the
Definitely.
Good energies.
Definitely.
Rand Afrikaans Universiteit.
Yeah.
This
yeah.
is now
yeah.
proper Afrikaans
yeah.
setup.
Yeah.
Nothing like what you would have anticipated
yeah. Yeah.
before.
Yeah.
And your currency here is success, if
yeah.
anything is going to go.
That's right. I mean, when I heard about an opening here, it was through my mentor, Professor Esther van Kerken, that I mentioned at my inauguration. And I worked briefly with her, and I came here for an interview. Oh, I thought long and hard. I thought, hey, Rand Afrikaans University. Those guys are going to give me hell. But I said, let me go and check it out. You know, I needed a job because at Vista, at the stage, I had month-to-month contracts. Drama and all those things. From their advert point of view, there was a job advertised of junior lecturer. Even today, I haven't heard from them. We are all applied, and Vista doesn't exist. So I come here. So that was the quickest job offer I ever had in my career. I came here at the Auckland Park Kingsway campus for an interview, and I took a taxi back to Pretoria. When I arrived in Pretoria, I got a phone call. I had this big Nokia phone that my older sister gave me. It rang. And then I was offered a job. Yeah, I was offered a job. That was the quickest job offer.
Same day.
I got a telephone call. Now when I talk to my colleagues, I say, but what will it take for us to go to do this? Because there are a few colleagues here who came here during their nowadays, professors who say, they had the same experience. They got a phone call the same day that you got a job offer. And then the details will come, you know, by email that evening or the next day, and they would get that. That is how serious and how quick things are. Now there are committees which are necessary for governance perspectives, but from a governance perspective, but we need to look into this, you know, that how quick our turnaround can be. I got my job offer the same day, and I was like, hey, this guy's mean business. And how wrong I was, because this place was good to me, was very good to me. It really helped me grow to the person that I am today.
Rand Afrikaans Universiteit.
Yeah.
And I suppose it's, if not before, certainly at this point, you
yeah.
are now starting to engage a bit of
yeah.
history,
yeah.
a bit of what history might have taught you, particularly
yeah.
around the Afrikaans community,
yeah. Yeah.
as they were at the hegemony of
yeah.
the apartheid
yeah.
system.
Yeah.
You now are joining, open close quote, their system
yeah.
in an environment that is largely their language.
Yeah. Yeah.
You're in every respect an outlier, a young
That's
black
right.
academic.
Yeah.
And you probably might not have seen yourself at any
yeah.
given time
yeah.
in the sort of world.
Yeah.
These complexities you are
yeah.
engaging, these identities now you are having to forge at
yeah.
the same time of an academic growth
yeah.
and the growth of a typical employee in a
yeah.
setup where excellence is clearly required.
Yeah. You know, you're right, but I'll tell you, I learned a lot through this experience. You know, it was not about who I am or I was. It was about what I bring to the table and the person I am. So I worked really hard. I got all the support that I deserved, and people went out of their way to support me during this. I was the only black person there. The other black men washed dishes. I can't tell you it was easy, because there were times when I needed my computer to be serviced and I would phone the ICS number, and people would ask me, are you a student assistant? I say, no, I'm an employee. And they would call to confirm whether there's such a person there. I was the first black person to be employed at the faculty with a PhD, doctorate. I was the first black head of department. I was the first vice dean. I was the first executive dean. Who is black. And colleagues went out of their way to support me. I remember I got a scholarship to go to Germany for 4 months, and I just started working here, and I was stressing, I don't have enough leave days. Will it be without pay or with pay if I go? I cannot afford that. I have a flat in Pretoria. And when I raised this, and the former dean said, no, we see this as part of your development. You can go for a month to Germany, and it will be leave with pay. and it will not even affect your annual leave. That was amazing. And I remember the smile on the face of the former dean when he saw my first article in the South African Mercantile Law Journal. And then I didn't even know there was subsidy if you publish in this place. And he said, hey, you must let us know. This is really good. He was so happy and encouraged me. And many other colleagues there went out of their way. I remember my plan was that as soon as I get my LLD, my doctorate in law, I will look for a job at an English university. And one of my colleagues and a good friend, Professor Cyril Du Toit, said to me, no, there will be something for you here. Because I thought my Afrikaans was terrible. Look, I can speak basic Afrikaans. I did Afrikaans theater. And I love languages.
Why?
And when I left, when I got a job in Europe, I had been offered a senior lectureship here at the then Rand Afrikaans University. This is the respect the colleagues had in me, the faith they had in me. And I believe I proved myself. But then I got a job in Munich. So I went to see the former dean and said, look, I don't want to sound ungrateful. And he laughed. He said, no, don't worry about it. Many people go to the Max Planck Institute or any Max Planck Institute as guests. You're going to work there.
Mm.
You can always come back. But when you come back, I will be gone because he was about to retire. He joked. And when I came back, many universities wanted my services. But I wanted to come back here because this place made me. I'm a loyal type of person. And I was like, if there's anything to do, you know, a difference I can make is here. The interesting bit is that there were also government departments that wanted to offer me chief director roles and with a lot of
money. In the public service.
Yeah, in the public service, which I turned down and I came for a quarter of that here. And my family members thought I was crazy.
This is now mid-2000s.
2006 to be precise.
Mm.
Yeah, and they laughed and said, are you crazy? But for me, it was not about money. It was about doing what I love and I enjoy. This is how principled I can be.
Specifically, labor law, social security law. Now, this is around 2006.
Yep.
And for 10 years,
yep.
Reconstruction Development Program,
yep.
Year,
yep.
Later ASCISA. Mm-hmm. This is now South Africa at a legal level. Giving effect to the Bill of Rights in Chapter 2 of the Constitution,
yeah.
Churning out these instruments that support not only the backlog, but also fashioning the new society that the Constitution envisages, all the while transforming towards the social ideals, the economic ideals, and political ideals.
Right.
You were clearly attracted to that because your scholarship is on labor law, is on social security law.
Right.
Tell us about the things you have vexed in your mind as you engage these critical disciplines of law, but of society at large.
Yeah. Look, I'll take you a step back. My father died during the course and scope of his employment, you know, in an occupational accident. And that changed a lot of things, you know. Those sales house pajamas were gone overnight. And we were raised, you know, by a small grant from the Workmen's Compensation Fund to the tune of 222 rands, 22 cents. I don't know how they arrived at this 222s.
Per month.
Five kids, can you believe it, that my mother had to raise. And she would receive this amount at the local post office on the first of each and every month. And one thing that stayed with me, I mean, this was not a lot of money, but my mother could use it, you know, in our small businesses. We sold everything from socks to smileys, you name it. She made jerseys and so on. So had it not been for this amount, I don't know where it would have been because my mother could use it in our small businesses and it raised us. You know?
Mm.
So I said to myself, labor law and social security are really important, you know. And if I can contribute either through teaching and or my research or both to develop the system to the point that it can help many others who find myself in my position, I shall have done a great thing, you know. So that is what attracted me to these fields of law and kept me there because this is about the people, ordinary people, the marginalized, you know, amongst us. the vulnerable amongst us. And whatever research I do contributes towards improving the lives of these ordinary people. So that is something that kept me in this world. I mean, people say, if you want to make money, don't go to labor law and social security law. And one colleague used to joke by saying the rewards of people who work in this area are in heaven. So it's not about, you know, making money, but about really empowering people. And this is something that is close to my heart. Impact. That's why we talk now at UJ as part of my vision is Global Excellence and Stature 4.0 for societal impact. We want to impact the lives of ordinary people. We want to make a difference.
We're going to go into your vision for the position you now have been in for 27 days.
Yes.
But if you look at South Africa now, South Africa 2023, literally 3 years on from COVID. In fact, 3 years to the day that the president told us that we're going into a proper lockdown.
Yeah.
In the last 3 years, if it was not apparent in the previous 25, 26 years, we now know in South Africa we have got some serious fissures in the arrangement of state resources, in the arrangement and deployment of persons to preside over state institutions and state resources. And this deficit manifests in corruption, in social unrest that is precipitated by the improper distribution, improper configuration, continued vulnerabilities of persons who in 1994 were designated as vulnerable. If anything has changed, is that now they have become even more vulnerable.
Yeah.
How do you then, as one who has sought to engage that in your life in law and in your leadership at academic institutions, view?
Yeah.
I mean, how would you put in words what South Africa is experiencing in the context of social security, socioeconomic development?
Look, I'll be honest with you. You know, the biggest challenge is having wrong people in right places. You can have good ideas, but if you have wrong people to execute them, is a problem. Somebody said something along the lines that hard work, you know, we see hard work not resulting in success, that people who are qualified to do certain jobs are being overlooked often. And those that occupy these positions are often not properly qualified to take care of what needs to be taken care of. We see success without work, wealth without work. And that is where the problem is. Today, you hear people telling you that they will be successful but without working. We grew up knowing that whatever you want to get, you have to attain it through hard work. We need to change that. In law, you know, you studied law yourself, Songe, so we know about this common law principle that it's a criminal offense if you have property or even wealth that you can't explain how you got it. You amassed it. And we have laws that seem not to be implemented as hard as they should be. So I think that is the starting point. Every young man out there, young woman, need to know that if I want to go somewhere, I need to work for that. And in terms of social security, a lot is being done. Beautiful work is being done to support the needy. I mean, our social assistance program is probably the largest on the continent. There's still gaps because our social assistance program provides for people who are young enough, old enough, or who are disabled enough, if I could put it that way, and who don't have the means. But the people in between have nothing. But at the same time, if you ask me, what I think is one of our biggest challenges is that our system is strong on paying out, but it's weak on prevention, preventing social risks from happening. And it's not strong on integration or reintegration. And this is going to be, actually, I should say, it's more important now than ever. People need new skills. People need to be reskilled. People need to be reskilled. People need to be skilled, given the challenges we're seeing now with 4IR technologies and so on. And if we don't address that adequately, we're going to be left behind. So there are a number of things that require attention. And there is also this thing that if you want quality, you should go to the private sector. don't expect quality from the public sector, which is unacceptable because why should I be required to accept poor service in the civil service?
Mm.
Or why should we expect that those that can cut it in the private sector should end up, you know,
in the public sector?
In the public sector. Service. Yeah. People would tell you, I remember protesting at one hospital where my younger sister was hospitalized, and somebody said, yeah, but remember, this is a public hospital. You can't expect to be.
Why not?
And I'm like, why not? But somebody said, no, keep quiet. They will sort of mark your relative and will not be served properly.
Which is an unfortunate truth,
yeah,
for the most part.
Exactly. So these are things we need to change, you know. And I would say to whoever is listening to this podcast that we should start asking ourselves, when are we going to be the first world? Let's have timelines and work towards that goal. I know we've got 2030 national plan and so on, but we need to up the things, you know, and say, when are we going to be the first world? Okay, we're going to give ourselves 50 years. This is what we're going to do. These are the people that we're going to need. These are the resources that we're going to need. Because at the moment, with all due respect, it looks like we're just flowing with the flow. And we can't have that.
Now, you've mentioned something, and unfortunately for those who are listening, we're going to have to do this in two parts.
Yeah.
We simply don't have the time.
Time, yeah.
But I do want to use this entry point as the final discussion,
yes,
around what takes you to the position of vice chancellor.
Yeah.
You see, you mentioned the question of skills.
Yeah.
I understand, and if I'm wrong, please correct me, that a majority of your students here are first generation students.
That's right.
In other words, they are breaking,
yeah,
poverty cycles at
That's
home.
That's true.
Or they are establishing certain cycles for the better.
Yes.
Either way, there's a backlog, therefore,
yeah,
that is being serviced at first year level.
Right.
In other words, this is a 19-year-old, maybe an 18-year-old. Mm. In many respects, somewhat too late,
yeah,
in the arrangement,
yeah,
of society, that a 19-year-old is being requested to do certain things only for the first time now.
Right.
And which is more so much responsibility,
right,
on the shoulders of that young person.
Yeah.
What can you remark? If you were in the space of basic education,
yeah,
if you were in the space of health, if you were in the space of social development, and they were in this room, same time, and what you say to them,
yeah,
will happen. What would you say to them to give you, with all these challenges, a 19 and an 18-year-old,
yeah,
in a position where he or she can use these 3 to 4 years they have with you to really break that cycle and establish a new order for their homes, for their societies, and by extension for the country? What would you want to happen,
yeah,
with those institutions there?
Yeah, look. I know we don't have time, but if you ask me to say one sentence about this, I would say, let's make sure that every person involved in these institutions, from the top to the bottom, appreciate the importance of their roles in transforming the lives of ordinary people for the better. It starts with that teacher that wakes up early in the morning, determined to empower this kid. It starts with that school principal that wakes up in the morning, determined, his belly or her belly filled with fire, passion that I'm going to transform the lives of these people. I saw it firsthand. I mean, Advocate Ramaphosa was a teacher at my school. You could see it in his eyes. You could hear it in his voice that this guy wants the best for me, despite the shortage of resources. You know, we had to imagine experiments instead of doing them as other people do. But there's a saying that, Songezo, if you are wet standing in the rain, you don't wet yourself because you're already wet. And that is about dignity. So if everyone appreciates his or her role in breaking the cycle of poverty, we'll go somewhere. Starting with officials, you know, SASSA officials.
Mm.
That treats people with respect. I'm not saying all of them don't,
sure,
you know, but we hear and read of cases. It comes to us here when these kids come to our universities. We see them as, you know, future leaders and support them. But also them taking their, you know, lives seriously, appreciating the fact that the rights come with responsibility. So I think what I'm getting at is that preachers must preach, farmers must farm, singers must sing, and so on. You can't have a situation where you've got a farmer that doesn't farm but expects to have some produce at the end of the season. So everybody must bring his or her part. And the setup must be of such a nature that there is accountability all the way.
Yeah.
And that is the only way we'll change this country of ours. You have people waking up, sitting there, police sleeping, you know, when they should be policing. You've got nurses that should be nursing that are not nursing. You've got teachers that should be teaching that are not teaching. You've got lecturers that should be lecturing, but you find that they are not lecturing. Leaders that should be leading that are not leading. So it's one thing that we need. We should go back to basics. And the last thing is that, you know, our limited resources must be treated with the respect that they deserve. You know, I worked in Germany for 3 years, and people who tell you this are taxpayers' monies that must be treated with respect. In our part of the world, taxpayers' money are not treated with the respect that they deserve. It's almost like this, you know, it's free for all, you know. Eat as quickly as you can, you know. And also, we need the people to hold our elected officials accountable. We have to. People must go out and vote. This thing that I'm not going to vote is not going to help. We shouldn't complain about the type of leaders that we get, because we, the electorate, you know, have a role to play as part of that thing of holding people accountable.
Finally,
yeah,
we are at a stage now where the Vice Chancellor, Professor Letlokwa George Mbedi, is sitting in his position 27 days in.
Yeah.
The next part of the series is to engage the position, what it requires of you, who its critical stakeholders are, and how together these bodies and offices give life and expression to this vision that you want a decolonized University of Johannesburg. You want a University of Johannesburg that is contributing to the economy, not just the knowledge economy, but the economy in the truest sense, and how technology in the advent of the fourth industrial revolution has a role to play in that, so that from village to the world and beyond, everybody is contemplated. I do want to give us a whole time dedicated to that, because it would serve an injustice to rush it in the name of meeting time. For now, mine is to simply express and extend to you my gratitude for the gratitude and latitude you've given me in terms of your time and the free rein that I've had in this conversation. And I certainly look forward to the next itinerary.
Yeah, thank you so much, Songezo. As always, I enjoyed engaging with you. You know, I really appreciate the time you've set aside for this conversation. We have a responsibility to inspire that humble girl, you know, walking barefooted at a village. That humble young man that has dreams. I say dreaming is free. And that young man, you know, young girl at a township, even those at the suburbs, you can stay at a suburb without a vision. We have a role to say, come dream with us. And together we can take this country of ours forward. No one will come and take it forward on our behalf. We all have a role. So thank you so much. And I'm looking forward to our next conversation.
No more than I am. Professor Letlokwa George Mbedi. That was the first session. The second continues.
The University of Johannesburg, the future reimagined.